Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, the director of the Huff Eines Institute. I want to take a little bit of time to tell you about this great event that we have coming up, the Huff Eines Discussion 4. We do this every year, and this year it's November the 21st from 1 to 4 p.m. Central Time in the Annenberg Presidential Conference Center here on the campus of Texas A&M. If you're in the area, you're certainly welcome to attend. It's free of charge. You'll hear 9 speakers that are leaders in exercise science and human performance. They have all been picked because they have a great message to say, and they are great speakers. If you're not in our area, don't despair, because there are other ways that you can get to the Huff Eines discussion. If you look on our website, you'll find that there are 23 satellite sites around the country that will be simulcasting the event at the same time. If you're near one of those sites, click on it and contact and find out where that's at, and you can go see it there. We will be putting these videos up online probably right after the first of the new year, and so you'll be able to see them there. So we hope to see you there on November 21st. And now, on to the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huff Eines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huff Eines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huff Eines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huff Eines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. We're so glad that you took the time to download us and you're listening. As we do every week, we have another person in the studio that's an interesting individual in the world of sports medicine and human performance. We have with us Dr. and Lieutenant Pat Doherty from the Navy today. Welcome to the podcast, Pat.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. I'm going to tell the folks a little bit about you,
sure.
And then we're just going to jump right into the conversation. Pat has several degrees. He has a bachelor's degree in exercise science from Ithaca. He has a master's degree in kinesiology from here at Texas A&M and a PhD in biology from here at Texas A&M as well. After he finished his PhD, he went into the Navy, where he is currently what we would consider an aerospace physiologist. He works with the Aerospace Operational Command. He has recently been recognized for his role in some of the investigations that he's done that have happened as a result of some mishaps, and we're going to ask him about that a little bit later. But we're so pleased to have Pat here. He's on campus actually doing some seminars for our graduate students, and we've strong-armed him to come over here and spend some time with us today. So again, thank you for being with us today, Pat.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you here. So we're just going to get started off with a real simple question. How'd you get into aerospace physiology? That's not a kind of a normal career path for an exercise science person.
So I got into it when I was finishing my PhD work. I was looking at career options after graduate school, and I thought I wasn't a very good researcher. So I was looking at alternative careers and did some Google searching for the military. I had thoughts about joining the military after 9/11, which happened not long after I started grad school. But then I'd spent 8 years in graduate school and didn't want to not use that education I'd gotten. So I looked at the programs that were offered that the military had, Air Force, Army, Navy, related to physiology and exercise physiology, and saw that the Navy had both a research physiology and aerospace physiology program that I had the prerequisites for. So I spoke to a medical recruiter and talked to him at a job fair here on campus, and it sounded like something I'd be interested in. So I gave him my CV, and the research physiology program, it's very small and wasn't taking applicants for when I was anticipating graduating. So I said, hey, let's talk more about this aerospace physiology program. It looks pretty cool from the Navy website and what I've seen online. And that's basically how I got started. I went through the application process, which included a trip to Pensacola, where I got
the garden spot of the South. If you're in the Navy, right?
Yes, yeah. Redneck Riviera. It's a great spot. And I went through the interview process there and wasn't too much of an idiot. And they offered me a position, and I gladly accepted. And 5.5 years later, I'm still doing it, enjoying myself.
Well, so many people think about exercise science as being involved with sports and athletes and so forth. People forget that our military, they are we are concerned with human performance. I mean, so many people now call them war fighters as one of the terms. So what do you do in your position, and how do you relate the exercise science part to all that?
It is a very superficial application
of exercise
physiology. So for our role in as aerospace operational physiologists, a large part is with training, education of warfighters, with regard to, one, the physiological threats associated with the flight environment. So those would be things like spatial disorientation, loss of consciousness due to G-forces, hypoxia recognition, then basic performance management stuff. So fatigue, stress management, sleep, nutrition, exercise, things like that. So we provide some of that training is required annually, and then other stuff is pre-deployment, and then other is as needed. If the command says, hey, we'd like you to come talk to us about fatigue or stress or operational stress control, things like that, I'll go and give them a brief, basically.
Sure. Now, I was involved in some of this stuff back in the 80s, and there was a big concern at that point about aerobic training and resistance training for pilots, and how that would affect G tolerance in particular.
Okay.
And so, is that concern still there? You guys work with them? Do the pilots do any type of particular exercise, or can you talk about that, or is it all top secret?
It's not top secret. I think the literature, what's shown is that resistance training, it has been shown in some studies to increase G tolerance. Aerobic training, I think, has been somewhat equivocal, whether they're fit, they're not fit. And I think, the dogma is, if you're more aerobically fit, then your resting tolerance will be lower because, being healthier is associated with lower resting blood pressure. But the total G tolerance isn't just based on your resting. It's your ability to do this training technique and sustain Gs for a long period of time. And I think the benefits of aerobic and resistance training, outweigh that slight decline in resting tolerance in terms of increased endurance and just ability to continue to fight during the sustained G's.
So you mentioned straining maneuvers. Tell us a little bit more about those. Those are actually pretty strenuous.
They are. So I actually worked at the human centrifuge trainer out in California prior to my current position down in Corpus Christi. So I got very, very familiar with the strain technique called the anti-G strain maneuver, and it's basically a coordinate contraction, isometric contraction of all the muscle in your lower body and in your abs, then a breathing technique. And the technique we use in the Navy, it's called the Hick maneuver. It's just basically a Valsalva, which you hold for 3 seconds, then you do a rapid air exchange, and then re-engage that that breath hold. The Air Force is a little bit different based on some of the equipment that they have in their jets, but so it is fatiguing. So you need to be fit to be able to continue doing it.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I have a brother that was in the Marines. It was a aviator in the Marines, and that's what's his biggest criteria or criticism of all these movies that have, you hear the radio chatter from the guys in the jets during these maneuvers, and he says, "Well, that's so unrealistic because they don't sound like that when they're doing those straining maneuvers because it's actually interesting sounding."
Probably some grunting.
Probably a little bit of grunting.
Yeah,
right?
Heavy breathing.
Yeah. But that's the difference between them staying conscious and passing out.
Very likely it could be.
Yeah. So did you ever get in the centrifuge?
On several occasions, I did. So it only makes sense if you're going to train somebody to tolerate G's that you need to have experienced G's. So, so we have a few sets of protocols that we would use. And I tried all of them. Basic protocol that everybody goes for their initial training, and we train up to 7.5 G's, and then for some other folks they fly higher performance aircraft, so we train them up to 9, and then the Blue Angels had their own sets of profiles that we would train to, and that they were all stressful in their own right, and then I actually volunteered for a study that the Navy was conducting, looking at the use of chemical, biological, radioactive gear for tactical aviation and, you know, changes to that. So I got to do the centrifuge training wearing basically a rubber hood on my head, which was...
That does not sound fun.
It added some additional stress to the evolution.
The typical understatement. Yeah, yeah, right. So I guess give the audience a little bit of an idea of what baseline is. So at a relaxed state without the straining maneuvers, kind of what's an average tolerance that people can handle before they pass out?
So it's going to depend on the individual and their resting blood pressure, some other physical factors, distance from their heart up to their brain and things like that.
Yeah, taller people are not good.
Yeah, taller people tend to struggle.
Yeah.
But on average, we would... you see people, we wouldn't necessarily test them to lose consciousness, the training to prevent that. Right. But usually around 5 G's plus or minus is where people, without straining, without any other protection, you lose consciousness based on hemodynamic factors.
Yeah. And I want the audience to catch that because that's a baseline of about 5, and they're training them up to about 9 G's, as
right.
what you said. And most of these planes now can well go over 9 G's if they put them in the right configurations.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, not not for a sustained period of time, but
right.
Transiently, they're very capable. And some ways, the human is the limiter.
Yeah.
And the capability of the jet.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of an interesting thought. The human being inside becomes a limiting factor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So as you expose these pilots to G's, do they get better? And one of the things that we'd always seen, I guess, was that if you take a pilot off the flight line for any period of time, their G tolerance kind of went down.
Yes.
And then there was some physiological adaptation
mm-hmm.
to that.
Yeah, and there have been some published reports of that, just looking at recency of exposure and how that affects their... G tolerance and some tilt tests done. And yeah, absolutely. If you have somebody who's been exposed, then their cardiovascular reflex is more robust. Their resting blood pressure tends to be higher. If they go without flying, then mean arterial pressure comes down. Response to tilt isn't as strong. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, there's an effect of exposure.
That's pretty cool that the human body can actually adapt.
Yes.
It actually makes things a little bit better.
Yeah, body's pretty smart.
Yeah, body's pretty smart. Yeah, so one of the things, and actually you just recently received an award, actually, from the Navy for this, was for some of your work and looking at some of the survival gear in a recent incident that we can't talk about. You've already told me you'd have to kill me if you told me about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would be a very short podcast, Alan. So tell us a little bit about that and kind of what you've done in the material support side of things.
Part of my role as the air medical safety officer involves being a liaison between the operator and engineers and maintainers mm-hmm. with regard to survival gear. And in the mishap, there were some problems with some of the survival gear. And there's differing opinions between those operators and maintainers and engineers as to whether the gear was fit for use. So mm-hmm. I was involved with a mishap investigation, and as part of the investigation, did some testing of the gear and was able to reproduce the same failure that had occurred during the mishap, and that. Raised the eyebrows of the engineers and brought light to the fact that, yes, this is an actual threat,
mm-hmm.
So that they've gone on board and more actively assessing and correcting the underlying issue.
I mean, these are serious matters. I mean, we're laughing here, but when we talk about sports, really, if we're talking about differences in shoes, that's not that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're talking about, when you say survival gear, this is life support gear that will keep somebody alive.
Yes.
And so, your mission in this case is to make sure that it does keep people alive.
Right.
And it doesn't fail. So that is a big deal.
Yes. We were very lucky that the air crew survived the mishap. And, I had a witness to interview.
Mm.
As far as what happened with the survival gear.
Mm-hmm.
And then otherwise, if that wasn't the case, then it's easy to say, well, he probably did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to interview the individual and was told this is what I did. And I was able to use that and you know, work with the engineers and, you know, do some testing. And yeah, the implications are, you know, correcting that malfunction, that issue, will affect, you know, the entire fleet.
Right.
So if, you know, somebody else is wearing the same gear and they're presented with the same situation in the future, you know, that issue should not happen.
Right.
If we do, you know, identify and then correct it.
That must make you feel good to potentially save lives by doing this kind of investigation and figuring this stuff out.
That's, you know, what I'm supposed to do. So it's good. I'm a good learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of what the role of the aerospace physiologist is, and, you know, how do we support the warfighter,
mm-hmm.
Support the operator, and it was good. Once, you know, we got the engineers on board, it was, you know, there's a little bit of satisfaction for them to say, yep, I believe you now, and yeah, to potentially save somebody's life. It's a good feeling. Definitely.
You didn't like do a little dance and say, I told you so, when the engineers came on board?
No, that's not my style.
That's non-military.
Yeah. Well,
that might have happened in the civilian world.
Some people may do that, but yeah,
that's not what you do. Yeah. Well, you know, and it's interesting you bring this up about the equipment, or we talk about the equipment thing, because so many people talk about aerospace physiology and they think just about the human factor side of things. But if you don't have the support equipment, I know that 60 Minutes did a piece, I don't know, a year or so ago on the new Raptor fighter,
right,
and some of the issues that they were having,
mm-hmm.
with some of the G suits and some other things on that. And not that that was the problem, that was just kind of the overall,
right,
thing. And it wasn't the human factor in that, it was some equipment that was causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
So as a physiologist, you have to deal with the engineers and you have to help them see the light sometime.
Yeah, it's like I said, we work as a liaison quite a bit, and at times you wonder, like, what do I actually do?
Mm.
But it's, you know, there's a lot of communication and making sure that, you know, people are, you know, fulfilling their responsibilities. And it's a bridge that, you know, is important. Otherwise, things get dropped and, you know, the issues persist because, mm-hmm. you know, engineers and operators don't communicate all the time. So.
And so while you hope there's not an accident, when there is, you want that gear to work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, imagine, like, you know, your plane stops working, so you have to get out of it, and then you're trained. This is how you use your survival gear. And this is what's going to save your life. And when that gear doesn't work, it's like,
what do you want to do now?
Right. Like, there's a...
You're up a creek and you lost a paddle or two.
Yep, exactly. So it was good to, everything, you know, has been working out with the mishap investigation and, you know, getting things corrected.
Cool. So what do you see as the future? When you see, as for aerospace physiology, what do you think, what do you think coming in 5 to 10 years?
I think we're continually, gears changing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll continue, you know, introducing, you know, new gear, you know, to the air crew.
To try to get over the human factor issue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just to make it, I guess, the human system integration better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with, you know, the new, you know, F-35, you know, that's a big part of the program, is the survival gear, mm-hmm. and make sure it works for, for the pilot. You know, longer term, I think, you know, the future is, I mean, you know, unmanned flight.
Mm.
And, you know, there's been a lot of testing of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making sure that, you know, those operators, you know, are able to perform.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, you know, in the aircraft, but they still have, you know, stress and human factors to consider. So, yeah, just, you know, keep up with the advances in the technology so that, you know, the warfighter is able to, you know, use it and continue to perform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know with some of the remote drones and so forth, they say one of the biggest issues is psychological, because
mm-hmm.
you're in the box, you're flying during,
right,
the day, and then you walk out and you're home.
Right.
And so you're not in that mission environment that has been the case in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very difficult situations.
Yeah, you spend all day, you know, just, you know, looking at, you know, someplace in theater, and then you go home and there's meatloaf on the table.
Yeah. So I think we're about hitting our time limit here. So, Pat,
okay.
So as we always do with our guests, we give them an opportunity to give us a take-home message. So what if there's one thing you want people to remember from this podcast, what do you think that would be?
Yeah, for the students, you go to graduate school for I think most of us go in thinking we're going to be a professor or something like that. But there are alternate careers available, and I think that's part of the reason I was brought in to give the seminar, just to shed light on one possibility. Mm-hmm. And being a naval aerospace operational physiologist, it's been I'm really enjoying it, and it's definitely get a lot of fulfillment from what I do. At times, it's fulfilling, and helping operators do what they are, what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. You have real you have real impact.
Yeah, and it's direct, mm-hmm. and that's rewarding.
And at the end of the day, that's what we hope we all have, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Pat, we've had a great time chatting.
Right, absolutely.
And I'm glad that you've been with us today. And so for those of you that listen to us regularly, and maybe those that listen to us on an irregular basis, you know that this is the time of the podcast when we have the podcast question of the week. And here with the podcast question of the week is our producer, Ayland.
What type of training can improve resistance to G-forces?
Excellent question, Ayland. And be the first one to send us the email with the correct answer to the question, and you'll win one of our nifty podcast t-shirts. So again, thank you all for taking the time to join us. Pat, again, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we hope that you all take the time to download and listen to us next week, when we'll have another interesting person from the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Ayland Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.